curious space and fires in orbit. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Kids ask the best questions. That's why we're turning the mic over to young space enthusiasts wanting to ask an astronaut their questions about space exploration. For our second Curious Space segment, we've got more questions for our young friends about what it's like to eat and live in space.
What do they eat in space?
Is it true that you eat freeze-dried food?
Is the food disgusting?
Veteran NASA astronaut Winston Scott joins us once again for those answers. Then one researcher is studying wildfires from orbit. We'll speak with Worcester Polytechnic Institute's James Urban about his experiment that recently arrived at the International Space Station on a resupply mission and how he's monitoring flames in space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? We're turning the mic over to some of our younger space enthusiasts with a new segment on Are We There Yet? Called Curious Space. I took a trip to the Orlando Science Center last month during Astrofest to ask kids what they wanted to know about space and what it's like to be an astronaut. We put those questions to veteran NASA astronaut Winston Scott. Winston, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be back. I always have a lot of fun doing these. Appreciate you guys inviting me back.
Me too, Winston. And I've got to tell you, we were back out at the Orlando Science Center. Just a little background, we were asking these questions during lunchtime. So that might give you a sense as to this first round of questions. This is a culmination of questions from Bibi, who is 8, and Stephen and Presley, who are both 10 years old.
What do they eat in space?
Is it true that you eat freeze-dried food?
Is the food disgusting?
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. We eat the same foods in space that you guys eat here on Earth. For example, I might have scrambled eggs, I might have sausage patties, I can have milk to drink, orange juice, and so on. Some of the foods are what we call freeze-dried, and some of them are dehydrated, so we have to reinsert the water into the food to make it look and taste like what it's supposed to be. But when you prepare the food, you get it ready, it's not disgusting. Some of the foods are actually pretty good, not as good as home cooking, but pretty good food. So that's kind of how it is in space.
Winston, did you have a favorite food to eat in orbit?
For breakfast, again, my favorite would be scrambled eggs and sausage patties. That's what I eat most. I also had cornflakes. Now, for lunch or dinner, I might have barbecue chicken sandwich or maybe barbecue beef with spiced rice and so on. I like drinking coffee in the mornings. I had nice, strong Kona coffee. One food that was really, really good, in my opinion, was the shrimp cocktail. Mm. And for the youngsters, if they have not had shrimp cocktail, next time mom and dad take you to a restaurant, ask to try some shrimp cocktail.
I've got to imagine eating cornflakes would be rather difficult in microgravity. Did you have dry cornflakes or did you use milk with your cereal?
Well, the milk and the cornflakes are all mixed in one bowl. It moisturizes it. Now, it's mushy. They're not as nice and crunchy as cornflakes on Earth. They stick. They don't float all over the place the same as it would if they were nice, crispy cornflakes. So
the shrimp cocktail, a much better choice then, is what you're saying.
Right. Absolutely. You know, sticking with the food theme, we had real ice cream in space. We had a specimen freezer that we took in orbit with us. We were going to grow plants in space and store the plant specimens in the freezer and bring them back to Earth. Well, on the way up there, obviously the freezer was empty. So we stocked it full of Dove ice cream bars.
Right. Our next question comes from 10-year-old SJ.
What is the farthest you've ever been in space?
SJ, well, the furthest I've ever been in space is low Earth orbit, which we consider about 250 miles above the Earth. So that's not very far. Now, as you know, back in the 60s, we sent astronauts to the moon, but we haven't sent astronauts to the moon in over 50 years. That was before my time. So our astronauts now all go to low Earth orbit, and low Earth orbit is typically around 250 miles. So that's the furthest that I've been in space.
That's farther than I've been. All right, this one's a little out there, but I'm going to throw this to you anyways. This is from Shenandoah, who is 12 years old.
Do you honestly believe aliens are real?
Shenandoah, that's a good question. I wish that we were face-to-face because I got to ask you that same question. Let's put it this way. I believe that there in the billions and billions and billions and billions of planets in existence, there must be a planet someplace out there that has life on it.
This next one comes from Levi, who's 9 years old. And if I recall correctly, we were chatting a bit about the Starliner mission that's happening right now. And the astronauts are waiting to get a ride home. So I think this may have had something to do with Levi's question. So here's what Levi had to ask you.
How do you not get stuck in space?
How do you not get stuck in space?
Levi, that's a good question. I'll tell you what. No one wants to be stuck in space. And the way you not get stuck in space is to be sure your equipment, your ship, and all of its systems are working properly. Now, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Starliner up in orbit right now and the problems they're having with it. Remember, that's a test flight, a test vehicle. So they're bound to encounter some problems, but they're working through those problems, and hopefully we'll get the crew home soon. But a spaceship is kind of like a car in a way. When you get in your car and drive off someplace, you try not to worry too much about being stuck out there on the highway. It's possible, but probably not. And back to the Starliner and other spaceships, we try to build them so that they are reliable and they have redundant systems. So that if something goes wrong, we can still get the astronauts home.
Winston, I'm going to follow up that question and ask you, what do you have to do to get through the atmosphere of Earth, right? It takes a lot of energy to punch through it and get into orbit. Does it take the same amount of energy and planning to make sure that you can get back through the atmosphere and back home safely? How do you do that with a space shuttle?
You're right. It does take a lot of energy. We are literally brute forcing our way into orbit. And rockets, of course, put out millions of pounds of thrust. For example, the space shuttle generating about 7.5 million pounds of thrust. Thrust is the push. So yeah, it takes a lot of energy to get up there. It doesn't take as much energy to get back because gravity pulls you back. So the problem with coming back is that you have to control the application of gravity. So it doesn't take as much energy to come back from the ship because gravity is providing that energy for you. But yes, we're literally brute forcing our way into orbit. Until we learn how to beam people up and down, we're going to be doing this for a long time.
I'm looking forward to the beaming up and down. That seems like a lot less work, doesn't it? All right. Amelia, who is 8 years old, has a similar question about what it's like to kind of be in space for an extended period of time. This is what she asked from the Orlando Science Center.
Do you actually go space crazy from being in space too long?
Well, Amelia, that's a good question. Thus far, we have not had anybody go space crazy. And we've had a few astronauts who've been in space for a year, approximately 1 year. So what happens over many, many years, we don't know yet. Also, when people are selected to become astronauts, we have a lot of doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists interview these people to be sure they're not likely to go space crazy. You want people who are emotionally healthy and mentally healthy so that they don't go space crazy. Because as you can imagine, if you got crazy in space, oh my goodness, that would be a disaster. So we don't want that to happen.
How long were you in space during your missions? And did you think that you filled the time with plenty of things to do?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, I'm a space shuttle era astronaut. So during the shuttle era, we flew for a week, 2 weeks at a time. My longest flight was 16 days. Mm-hmm. Now, astronauts today who go to the space station stay for 6 months at a time. So each generation of astronauts stays longer and longer and longer. And the other answer to your question is, yes, there's a lot of stuff to do. There's always something. The days are full. And in my day on the shuttle, of course, the days were full with work, with a little bit of spare time. So, yeah, your days are busy, but you have to balance that busy work with recreation. That's very important to good, healthy astronauts.
And Winston, 16 days, that's more than 2 weeks. Did you get homesick? Is there something that you missed while you were off this planet, essentially?
Yeah. You know, yeah. 16 days is not long enough to really get homesick per se. You know, it goes by fast and you're busy all day, every day. You try and enjoy every minute you're up there because you know you're going to come home soon. You don't know if you're going to go back again. The things that you miss, of course, are a long hot shower because you don't have a shower in space. So you like to have the water just run down over your body and your head, get long hot shower. You miss the home cooking. space food is okay, but it's not like home cooking or good restaurant food. So yeah, all the amenities of being at home are the things that you miss on a 16-day mission. Now, I imagine a 6-month mission, a little bit different. Yeah, you're probably getting a little more homesick on a 6-month mission than a 16-day mission.
I don't know if I could give up my hot showers, Winston. I think I'm reconsidering going to space.
Oh, hey, you miss a lot of luxuries being in zero gravity, I tell you.
Well, speaking of zero gravity, Micaiah has a question about that. Here's what she had to ask.
Is it fun to float?
Micaiah, it is so much fun to float. You get to fly like Supergirl or Superman. You push yourself off and you fly across the room and then you stop yourself. You can do flips and somersaults and tumbles and all kinds of fun things. And you know what else, Micaiah? You get to play with your food. Now, when you sit at the table, at dinner table at night, and mom says, don't play with your food, don't do it. But when you become an astronaut, only when you become an astronaut, you can play with your food. And at zero gravity, your food floats all over the place, and you can sort of fly through the air and chase it down and gobble it up. So you play all kinds of fun games in zero gravity. Lots of fun.
That leads us into our final question from Levi, who is 9 years old. I saved it for last. I know I'm not supposed to play favorites, but I think this is my favorite question. And I'm very interested to hear the answer to this one. So this is what Levi had to ask.
How do astronauts not throw up when they take off or if they're in space?
How do you keep that shrimp cocktail down, Winston?
A lot of people do not throw up. You may feel a little queasy, but you don't necessarily have to throw up. There are medicines you can take to prevent you from throwing up. And if somebody does feel like they have to throw up, they use an air sickness bag. It's a little bag that you put over your mouth and you kind of go in the bathroom by yourself and then throw up, and then when you get done, you put that bag in the garbage, and you wash your mouth out, and so on, and you go on about your business. So, you know, that's unfortunately something that happens occasionally to people, but you keep a sickness bag with you so that you can throw up in that bag and not let it get all over the room. And then you just, clean yourself up, and you carry on the same as you do on Earth.
I think we ended our conversation last time about sneezing. We're ending our conversation about barfing. We're taking care of all of the gross stuff about space. So, well, listen, but before I let you go, I just want to ask you about your work now at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. We have this opportunity where we get to go out in the community, collect questions to bring to astronauts like you on this show. But you're curating conversations with astronauts pretty much every day at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. If a listener here in Central Florida wants to head out there and talk to an astronaut with these questions, how are they able to do it?
They can do it by going online to the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, and they can purchase passes to come out to the Space Center and visit. And the Space Center Visitor Complex is open every day of the year except Christmas and New Year. So 363 days we're open. And every one of those days, we have a real live flown astronaut on site. And they can visit with the astronaut, take pictures, ask questions with him or her, sign autographs. All of that stuff is available. So again, just go online, Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, purchase your tickets and come on out. And I tell you what, it's a really fun place to visit.
We've been speaking with Winston Scott. He is a veteran NASA astronaut. If you've got a question for Winston for our Curious Space segment, we'll put some instructions online as to how to email those to us. And maybe we could chat more about sneezing and barfing and all the gross stuff in space with Winston next time. Winston, thanks so much for joining us. What a fun conversation as always.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much. I look forward to next time.
That was veteran NASA astronaut Winston Scott for our second installment of Curious Space. Do you have a young space enthusiast who has a question or two about space exploration? Well, you can record a voice memo and send it to us. We may use it for a future episode. Include your first name and age and email it to arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. And a big thanks to Orlando Science Center for hosting us at the AstroFest event. And a note, Orlando Science Center is a sponsor of Central Florida Public Media. Still to come, how do you study flames in space?
Basically, there's a big chamber that they put in the flow duct that's going to have this experiment in it, and that gets sealed, and it's inside a specific part of the ISS.
Fire on orbit. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Wildfires cause a lot of destruction here on Earth. That includes property damage, air quality issues, and more. Researchers are trying to understand more about wildfire behavior and how the flames spread. And one researcher is doing it hundreds of miles above Earth.
3, 2, 1, ignition, engine full power, and liftoff of Falcon 9, Ghost SpaceX, NG-21.
One such experiment was on board the Northrop Grumman's NG-21 supply mission to the International Space Station that launched this week from Cape Canaveral. The goal is to better understand how wildfires happen on Earth and how they can be controlled. Here to talk about how an experiment in space can help us here on Earth is James Urban, assistant professor in the Department of Fire Protection Engineering at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. My colleague Marion Summerall spoke with James just about how that experiment in space can help us here on Earth.
James, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
First off, congratulations on your experiment that successfully launched into space. And wildfires have been running rampant this summer because of this intense heat we're seeing. Let's talk a little bit about your research. You are trying to better understand these wildfires, but you're doing it in space, right?
The goal of this project is to better understand wildfires by trying to recreate some very similar wildfire-like behavior up in a microgravity environment where we can control the flow a lot better than we could, say, in a field experiment here on Earth. You know, wildfires are a very complicated process, and it's really hard to control the conditions in which they occur. I mean, most of the time, a real wildfire occurs under situations where we don't want it to occur. So this isn't really a nice laboratory where we can control a lot of things. And if we also were to try to replicate it at scale in a laboratory, that lab would have to be rather big. We do have a rather big laboratory here in my department, but it's still challenging to make very detailed measurements. And so what we're trying to do in this experiment is to go into microgravity where we don't have buoyancy. The flame is going to be much more responsive to the flow that we impose onto it. And so by imposing a non-steady wind flow that's going to blow over the burning sample, we're going to be able to control the flame with that behavior, and that's going to have a strong impact on how it spreads. In wildfire, we see something similar where the non-steady flame behaviors of a burning wildfire can affect how it spreads over a fine fuel bed, such as like dry grass. But this behavior is a combination of the impact of the wind and buoyancy that's driven by gravity that happens on Earth. And that's something that we can't really control. We have some degree of control, but not a lot. And especially as we shrink things down, we lose a lot of that control. Whereas in microgravity, if we're able to remove the effect of buoyancy and control it only by the wind that we're imposing, we think that's going to open up a lot of options for us when we do these experiments.
Why do you specifically have an interest in wildfire research? And why do you think it's so vital that we better understand wildfires? Why is this research so important?
In terms of how I got into doing this, I think there's a lot of ways to answer that. But ultimately, I think there's sort of two aspects of it. One is it's a very, I think, interesting topic. And there's also a lot of potential for impact. And so when I started my PhD, it was related to wildfires, and I really saw the potential to make that impact and that interesting problem. But also during my PhD, I was in California during several very, very large fires recently, and I, you know, saw the impact, you know, even as far away as I was from where the actual fire front was, but could also see the devastation that they caused on the built environment. And so that's kept me going on this topic.
We touched a little bit on this earlier, but really, what are the benefits of doing this experiment in space?
Ultimately, the thing that's really important is if we can find a better way to predict wildfire spread. There are a lot of models that exist, but some of them are only, none of them fully consider all the physics that are going on in a fire, because there's just honestly too much detail to resolve these fires in a meaningful amount of time. And so no matter what you do, you have to make a compromise. And ideally, in some ways, we would be using a physics-based model where we'd be only using the physics that we need and nothing more to make sure that we're grounded in reality, but also we're predicting the fire's behavior in an efficient manner of time. We need to better understand the physics, and the goal of this project is to understand how the non-steady flame behavior, which has a strong impact on the heating of the fuel that hasn't yet been ignited near the fire front, how that non-steady flame behavior impacts the heating of that fuel and igniting it, thereby allowing the fire to spread.
What do you mean by non-steady?
When you have these flames spreading across a fuel bed, say like imagine an acre of dry grass and there's a little grass fire going across that land. The flame isn't a solid object that's moving along and doesn't change shape. We're used to flames, flickering. You can think of a campfire. And when you have a line fire like this, there's been some research done by some folks, including especially the folks at the U.S. Forest Service in Missoula, Montana, that have shown that there are these non-steady flame behaviors that occur for various reasons through fluid dynamics that allow the flames to come into contact with the fuel in ways that are very effective for heating and igniting it. And that's been a very important finding with how these wildfires spread. But trying to make detailed measurements of this phenomena is very difficult because it only really happens at scale for multiple reasons. And so we're trying to create a similar system that's happening, but one where we can control all the variables so we can better understand how the flame behaves.
And your experiment is currently in space, but sadly, I do see you are on Earth. So you are not with your science experiment. So while the research is being done in space, what are you doing on the ground? What are you doing on Earth?
I'm actually totally happy to not be up in space. Oddly enough, I actually have a degree in aerospace engineering. Worked at NASA as an intern for 2 summers. I find it deeply fascinating, but I'm totally happy keeping my feet on the ground. Ultimately, what's going to happen is these samples are being sent up to the ISS. At some point, the crew is going to take the samples and stow them. But eventually, when they start doing the tests, they'll pull out a couple. There's a sample holder that'll hold them, and they'll put them inside the combustion integrated rack. And then ultimately, it's going to be controlled from a crew down on the ground, probably at NASA Glenn Research Center. And for some of those tests, I'll be able to be in the room or at least communicating with the people who are on the ground controlling the apparatus. I do think there's some things that the astronauts will be controlling, but I think a lot of it will be from the ground. And so in some ways, it'll be almost like I'm up there, but just peering through a computer screen.
This experiment, when you think of fire in space, right, and astronauts around fire, your immediate thought is that's a bad thing. How are you going to control the fire up there?
The experiment's being conducted in the SOFI insert, which goes into the combustion integrated rack. So basically, there's a big chamber that they put in the flow duct that's going to have this experiment in it. And that gets sealed, and it's inside a specific part of the ISS. And I'll admit, I'm not the foremost expert on this. But essentially, in that chamber, they can control the environment. And so as part of this project, we're sending up bottles of oxygen, or made of air, basically, to supply all the air that's needed for these flames. And so we aren't going to be relying on the crew's cabin air. Maybe just a little bit will get in there when they open it up. There's exchange at some point, but it's really not going to be drawing from the same air as them. And my understanding, too, is basically they have the ability to, I know they have the ability to even just vent whatever is inside this can or this chamber into outer space. And so it's totally fine if there's something nasty in there, they can release it onto space and it won't affect the crew.
This whole project is to better understand fires. What is the biggest goal that you hope to achieve with this research? And how does this impact the public with wildfires, right? Could this project help people feel safer around wildfires? I mean, what's the big goal here?
The big goal is to develop ultimately, and it's something that I'm not going to develop this project alone, but it's something that overall the community needs better ways of predicting what wildfires do so that we can make better intelligent choices about when to evacuate, what areas need to be protected better. And, just generally people can better understand what their risk is, both in the, immediate and also maybe in the long-term, more abstract sense. And I think this project is, small step forward in the goal of pursuing that. I think it also maybe does, highlight, though, that there is an effort to understand the physical processes that are happening when you have a wildfire. It's easy to dismiss it as this large cataclysmic thing that we, can't do anything about or learn much about, but we actually can design experiments to gain insight into how it works and then apply that at a much larger scale and test it and build these models that do predict that larger scale behavior well. Part of it too is I think just with microgravity, experiments, you never really know what you're going to get until you get the results. It's always surprising. My former advisor has had multiple missions that went on the space shuttle missions and then also on the ISS. And he says there's always something surprising, and you never really know until you get the data.
In your opinion, is there as much monitoring for wildfires as we see with, you know, let's say hurricanes and tornadoes? Currently, I'm in Florida, so we see a lot of hurricanes over here. Do you think, in your opinion, there needs to be more wildfire research?
Well, I think there needs to be more research, but also taking the lessons we learn from research, the insight we gain, and applying it to the real world too. And I think it's, you're talking about like monitoring, you know, events of like hurricanes, and, you know, satellites are used to monitor the progression of fires. But with fires, there's this aspect too of, you know, the risk of the fire and what we can do about it doesn't end or begin with the fire itself. There's a lot of things we can do, you know, when it's not fire season, when we aren't expecting a fire, to reduce the risk for when then there is the fire season, end quote. And I think maybe there needs to be a research to figure out what we can do during those times to be most effective to prevent the fires when they actually do come. Or I should say, not necessarily prevent them, but make them less severe so that they don't have this cataclysmic outcomes that we see today.
And your research is a step in the right direction, right? You're currently monitoring the experiment. You're able to interact with it and see your experiment being done in space. What's next, and what do you hope to find? And have you found anything really interesting so far while it's been up there?
Well, we haven't had a chance to actually get any of the data yet, but we're hoping to better understand how these non-steady processes impact spread and fire spread. And I think this is also part of a larger research program. You know, I'm burning plastic in space to understand wildfires, but we're also burning much larger fuel beds of vegetation to understand how wildfires spread at a much larger scale. This isn't the only thing we can do to understand how wildfires spread, but it's part of the bigger puzzle of trying to understand all of the complex and detailed physics that are present in this very dangerous and, but I guess, this very destructive phenomenon that's been that we've seen lately.
James Urban is the assistant professor in the Department of Fire Protection Engineering at WPI. James, thank you so much for coming on the show today, and congratulations on your experiment that's now in space.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you've got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. We're at awty@cfpublic.org. More space coverage on our website. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.